It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. We've got an exciting show for you for this first show of the year. I have an interview with Brad Micklejohn, who's pulled off something truly amazing. From seeing a movie about dam removal a few years ago, he got the idea to demolish a dam on the Aklutna River that has been blocking salmon for almost 100 years. Today, after Brad raised $7 million in private funds, the dam is almost gone. Also on today's show, for downhill skiers, we're going to be learning about how to keep your equipment in shape and safe for the best months of skiing that are ahead of us. And we're checking in with our training calendar on today's show. It's a monthly feature for those of you thinking about doing something big later in the year. But first, to start the show, I wanted to take a look at one of the biggest sports and outdoor stories in Alaska in the last year, the Iditarod drug doping scandal that hit the race in the fall, implicating Dallas Seavey's team with a positive drug test after his second place finish. I decided to sit down with a couple of experts on the issue to try to understand what it means and how it will affect the Iditarod. It's all coming up today on Outdoor Explorer, Alaska Public Media's audio outdoor magazine. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and in this segment, we're going to talk about the Iditarod. And usually our discussions about the Iditarod are always all, you know, exciting and the mushers and what's going to happen. But this year we've had kind of a different way of having to look at it with a doping scandal and some controversy around the Iditarod. And a lot has happened. It's been kind of hard to figure it all out. So I've got two guests in the studio. Well, one guest in the studio, one on the phone, to explain the controversy, the doping issue, and kind of figure out what's happening with the sport in terms of, you know, all the stuff that's going on around it. On the phone with us from where he's training out near Delta Junction is John Schandelmeyer. John is a musher and a trainer of dogs who writes about outdoor stuff. Thanks for being with us, John.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us.
And in the studio with me is Tegan Hanlon. She is a reporter with the Anchorage Daily News who has covered this the Iditarod and the issues that have been swirling around it for the last 6 months or so. Tegan, it sort of exploded into a big national brouhaha this fall when there was a positive drug test on Dallas Seavey's team. You know, what happened exactly that we know, and you know, in terms of like the bringings up to right now with those drug tests? It obviously, we didn't hear about it until the fall, and the race took place, last March. So that's like question number one. Like, they tested these dogs, they had some kind of positive thing, they kept it to themselves, and then suddenly it came out. What was that all about?
Yeah, Charles, so the race happens every year in March, and we heard about the positive drug test in October. The Iditarod Trail Committee Board of Directors, sort of the governing body of the race, put out a statement saying that they had decided to change race rules because several dogs on a team tested positive for a prohibited drug. At that point, we didn't know too much more who the musher was or where he or she tested positive or even how many dogs.
So they just threw it out there. We're changing the rules. And by the way, the reason we're doing it is because of this huge issue that we never told you about.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. And then they tried to keep it secret, and then it kind of burbled out. The mushers didn't like the fact that it was being kept secret.
You're right. Yeah, the rest of the information came out in a series of statements over the rest of the month. We found out that the dogs were tested in Nome at first, which kind of whittles it down. We know that the top 20 teams are tested in Nome. So then it sort of became a case of the top 20 mushers having to say, hey, by the way, it wasn't me. So at that point, it kind of narrowed the field of possibilities. And then eventually the Iditarod came out and said the dogs were on Dallas Seavey's team.
Right. So the drug that was used was a pain drug, right?
Yeah, it's called tramadol. It's a synthetic opioid. It's a painkiller. We know a little bit about it.
It's a super common dog drug. It's used by most veterinarians. It's prescribed after just a routine, like a spay or neuter. They either prescribe tramadol or rimadol, one or the other. And so it's something that I think I'd say 95% of mushers are very aware of.
I see.
It's not a drug that's like a mystery drug or, you know, by classifying it as an opioid painkiller, we make it seem like it's, like something special, but it's really a super common drug.
I see. So, John, it's something that would kind of be floating around in terms of this is something that mushers would have, basically just to deal with, as you say.
I would be willing to bet that any kennel that does any number of spays or neuters, I mean, just more than, you know, a couple of years, a year, would probably have some on their shelf. You know, mushers don't throw stuff away. So they don't throw anything away.
Right.
And so they've got normally after a spay or a neuter, you rarely really need much of a painkiller. And you're either going to be prescribed Rimadyl or Tramadol. And, I mean, I know that I have probably 3 or 4 bottles of unused Rimadyl around and a couple bottles of unused Tramadol around. That some of it might be 7 or 8 years old. I just don't use it. You know, it's tough on kidneys, and it's not something you use unless you need it.
Well, you mentioned, John, that you would use it after, you know, a spay or neuter or some kind of surgery, and I had a family member who had a surgery and actually was given this drug.
Sure.
What about, like human athletes, if you do a marathon or you do some kind of really long training activity, you might take some ibuprofen or something afterwards and just to be more comfortable. Is that something mushers do to kind of just make the dogs rest and feel more comfortable after a strenuous training activity?
I would say no. I mean, I can't speak for other mushers. We don't rarely even use it after a spay or neuter unless a dog shows like it might be in some kind of discomfort. And I doubt, I mean, I guess you could use it after, I mean, you certainly, the time to use it if you were going to do it, you know, to, you know, make a dog rest easier or to alleviate pain while he's moving would be, you know, at the end of a long race such as I did around. I mean, I would say that it would provide a significant boost at any point, you know, either after the race or during the race. It'd be like a high-powered aspirin would be the effect on a dog.
Right.
At least that's my view of it.
Well, let me turn back to Tegan Hanlon, the reporter from ADN. Dallas CV obviously has denied that he did this. What's Dallas's story, and how did he respond after this positive test result came out?
Sure. Yeah, after the Iditarod came forward and named him as the musher whose dogs tested positive, Dallas posted a pretty long video on YouTube explaining his side of the story. He strongly denied ever giving his dogs the drug, and he said he didn't know how it got in their system. He put out some theories, including that perhaps it was sabotage done by another competitor or by an animal rights group, but he said it definitely wasn't him.
Does that make any sense to you from having been there in Nome that somebody would be able to access dogs and give them a drug and then somehow as an act of sabotage? I mean, I've never been there at the end of the Iditarod, but it just seemed very far-fetched to me just hearing it described.
Yeah, you know, John can probably speak to this too. The Nome dog lot is partitioned off. People like me as a reporter, I could never get in. There's usually someone standing in the front keeping people out. They let in mushers and family members and handlers. So it's not as opened as it is, say, if you go to Tanana or some other checkpoint.
Mm-hmm. John, what do you think in terms of the credibility or sort of that theory of sabotage? Does that make sense to you?
Not in the dog yard. There was at the time that the dog, if somebody could have decided they were going to give Dallas's dogs Tramadol, he had a very short time window where that drug could have been given, where it would test as it did, and there was only 30 dogs in the dog yard, and there was a guy in there who actually we know who was in there, and he said nobody was in the dog yard at that period of time. So I just don't see it. Plus, I don't see any way you'd have to put the pill down the dog's throat.
Right.
You can't just put it in a treat and give it to him and expect that he would eat it, especially when you have four out of four positives and, you know, you have, all with approximately the same amount, which indicates that it wasn't given in food, you know, because not every dog might eat it.
On the flip side, though, it seems like if you're Dallas Seavey, why in the world would you give this painkilling drug to your dogs right before the end of the race, knowing that they were going to be tested? I mean, it seems like it would be very be a very poor strategy, because you would know you would get caught. Does that make sense? Let me throw it out to both of you. John, Tegan, what do you think about the, sort of that argument that it just makes no sense for him to do it?
Go ahead, Tegan.
I was just going to say, you know, I can just speak to what we know about the race and, what we know through covering it, and folks mm-hmm. who follow it, is that the top 20 mushers get tested in Nome, that their dogs do. It's a mandatory drug test. So Dallas, we would assume, knew that going in. He's won the race 4 times. He came in second in 2017. So he would know his dogs were getting drug tested.
I mean, it doesn't make any sense. John Chandelmeyer, your thoughts on that?
Well, I guess I have a little different take on that. I think, I have no idea. I'm not accusing anybody of giving the drug. I have no idea how the drug got in the dogs, but we know it did. So starting from that point, I guess given if you have any knowledge of tramadol, which I do now because I researched it pretty heavily, it is a drug with a very short half-life. And because no one is blood testing for the drug, they're only urine testing for the drug, and there's a total different way of testing. And you can also hair test for that drug to see if it's been given. And that lasts for like 60 days. So it's pretty easy to test for the drug if you are looking for tramadol. But if you're not looking for tramadol, if you're just looking for drugs, if tramadol was given, for instance, at White Mountain, then you can reasonably expect that tramadol would be out of the system by 6 hours after the finish of the race,
mm-hmm.
Which is when Dallas's dogs were going to get urine tested, and he knew that. I don't know how many other people knew that, probably a few. I have no idea why people dope. Why did Lance Armstrong dope? He knew he was going to be drug tested too.
Yeah, he was pretty good.
Nevertheless, people do. I don't know. It's conceivable that a handler, not mm-hmm. knowing of the 6 hour window that they were going to wait to take the urine test until 6 hours after his finish, not knowing that, might have decided that the dog was supposed to get a tramadol to help them rest after the urine test, which would have been totally legal.
Right.
After the dog is in home and
that would have been okay after the race is over, right, yeah.
Sure, and you have to look at the rule. The rule says, with intent to gain, the old rule, with intent to gain competitive advantage. And if you give that drug at Nome, there's no intent to gain a competitive advantage. It seems like it might be okay.
Right.
So you could look at it that way also.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking about the Iditarod and the controversies that have happened since the last race ended that have kind of brought it into the world of sport that we're used to, with all the externalities about doping and other issues, and not the pure sport at all. And so it leads us into understanding these drugs and speculating about what happened. And now with my two guests, I'd like to get into more the implications for the race and the future of the race and how this is playing out. My guests are John Chandelmeyer, who is a musher and trainer. He's reaching us near his remote training area near Delta Junction. And in the studio is Tegan Hanlon, who's a reporter with Anchorage Daily News and covers the race. I think that there was pretty broad agreement that Iditarod did not do a great job of handling this this event. Now going forward, they've got a big PR problem, and they've got a problem of sort of running the race and making it credible and getting beyond this. What's Iditarod doing sort of to move into the future on this?
Sure. So the Iditarod has talked about beefing up security for the 2018 race. They've thrown out some ideas about what that might look like, including surveillance cameras. They even talked about the possibility of mushers having sort of like GoPros on their sled to turn on at checkpoints. The Iditarod also recently announced that it was going to establish dog care standards that mushers competing in the race would have to meet. They said it would be a year-round program, and they put together a committee to form what those standards would be.
Yeah. I mean, that's been an issue for many years, and there was always a focus on just what's happening during the race and all the veterinary care during the race. But, of course, the dogs are being raised and trained 365 days a year, so that was always a little bit phony, I think, right?
Well, you have an issue, too, of, you know, the mushers are coming from across Alaska as well as across the globe. So how do you keep
how are you gonna monitor it?
Teams all over the world?
Right. Well, it's a funny spot for the race to be in, I think, because it grew up as this kind of casual, remote wilderness thing. And kind of the charm of it is going through these checkpoints and the village people are there, and it's really a fun Alaskan thing, but then it's sort of taking on this professional sports aspect, which is very contrary to that, and sort of gets very rule-based and very, and it's hard to see how you'd really totally change from one to the other. I mean, do you feel that way, Tegan?
Yeah, you know, I think the race is maybe trying to modernize a little bit. I'm not sure. It's become just a bigger sporting event. You know, as opposed to a race that a group of friends kind of put on for fun across Alaska. It's fast now, and there's teams training year-round, training hard year-round to win.
Yeah. So it's, John, what do you think? I mean, is it, maybe that transition happened a long time ago.
I look at it differently. I would say that this is the normal evolution of the sport. I mean, people used to run their, farmers ran their horses in the back pasture to see who was the fastest, and now we have the Kentucky Derby. Snowmobilers, I mean, look at, you know, 40 years ago, we ran the Midnight Sun 600 on the highway from Anchorage to Tilk to Fairbanks. People put their snowmobiles together in their shop and ran them down the highway. You know, today, there's nothing like that anymore because the sport evolves. We have factory teams, and now we have factory dog mushing teams. And you're not going to stop the evolution of the sport, so you have to evolve with it. I think the Iditarod made a great step by making their drug testing rules standard in the sport, the same as horse racing or greyhound racing or any other type of animal racing. Now, the challenge, of course, is off-season doping. I mean, if you're going to use a prohibited drug, there's nothing that prohibits you from using that drug in July, and there's no way of testing for it, because if I have a dog yard, well, let's just, since Dallas is in the news, let's pick Dallas. He has 100 dogs. And if does he know which dogs are going to be in his Iditarod team in 2019? Of course not. He might have a clue of his core, but he doesn't know the dogs,
right.
Neither does anyone else. There's no way of following dogs. Not all dogs are tattooed. Not all dogs are chipped. There's no way of following these dogs throughout their life. Now, one of the things Iditarod is trying to do is with this best care program, which is actually something they've been talking about for a year. It happens that our kennel presented the best care program to the Iditarod, which, you know, just it was an outline and it still is, and they, you know, formed an advisory committee to look at it, and they liked the name, so they called it Best Care. That program allows for the tracking of dogs from birth to death, which I think, as much as a musher, I don't want to see it, but I think we have to see it if we're going to race, and we're going to...
Right, because otherwise, I mean, you're in a situation where somebody could just be drugging up a dog and you know, theoretically, you know, is creating a monster, you know, of just a chemical thing. Yeah,
the sport needs transparency and it needs accountability, and every other sport has it. The Iditarod is going to have it also, and the sport of dog racing. If we're going to keep sponsors and we're going to keep fans, we're going to have to allow them to believe in us that we're doing things right.
Yeah.
And that we're trying, you know, and this, you know, in one way the sport is evolving toward, you know, more high tech and all that. And in the other way, this program brings it back a little bit because they're saying, hey, you know, you're supposed to run a dog as a dog, not, you're not supposed to dope. You're supposed to care for him properly. You know, in 1900, they had dog barns in Nome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, they did. They had big races. Yeah.
Keep them out of the wind. You know, they were taking care of their dogs because they were using those dogs, you know, for mail runs and freight transport and various things. And they took pretty good care of their dogs. I'm sure there was some abuse then also. But, you know, when there probably wasn't many drugs around.
I doubt it. Well, maybe a little whiskey or some, who knows, morphine. We're about out of time, but I want to ask Tegan, your sense of the upcoming race that's going to be getting started here in a few months. Do you think it's going to feel very different? I mean, are the rule changes or the issues going to change the feel of it, or does it seem like it's going to be, from the fans' standpoint, pretty much the same?
That's a good question, Charles. I think, in part, time will tell. If there is added security and it's visible, that might make it feel different. There are 69 mushers signed up to race, and that's around average.
Uh-huh.
We talked to a bunch of sponsors, and they largely said they were sticking with the race. We know that the purse is down next year, so that's a little different. But yeah, in terms of what race fans will see in Anchorage or Nome, or if they're along the trail, I guess I'm not quite sure just
yeah,
yet.
Yeah, I guess we'll see. And it's also, how will people feel? Yeah, mm-hmm. it'll be new. It'll be different. Yeah. Something to look out for.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to thank both of you. John Schandelmeyer, the musher and trainer who's working with dogs up in Delta Junction. Thanks for being with us, John.
You bet.
And Tegan Hanlon, reporter with Anchorage Daily News here in the studio in Anchorage. Thanks for coming in, Tegan.
Thanks for having us.
I'm Charles Wolforth. Please stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues. Winter is here with lots of thoughts of turns on downhill skis. In our next two segments, we're going to get you inspired and give you some practical information on equipment and safety. To start with, the inspiration. I have a piece from Alaska Public Media's India Alaska team, a piece created in 2013 by Travis Gilmore and Slavik Boyechko about Arctic Valley, the community-run ski hill northeast of town.
We're up at the Arctic Valley ski slope right now. And it's a volunteer ski slope run by the Anchorage Ski Club. Arctic Valley is a non-groomed slope. So we're here at Hog Heaven because we like powder, we like fresh tracks up there. You can find places no one else has been, and you can just carve your way down the hill and leave your mark. Most everybody here is a ski bum, and a lot of people here, they skied here as kids, and now they're back here to maintain their tradition and keep it going. It's a Merry Marmot Festival today. It's our spring fling. And we're having a lot of activities. We have downhill races. We have tube races. We have fat bike races. And my favorite is the dummy launch, in which people have made contraptions on two skis. And then we take it atop of a hill here. And we push it over the edge, and it goes down, and it flies in the air, and then it crashes. We get judged based on attitude, aptitude, altitude, and aplomb. Mine's just a big missile. It's 14 feet long and about 3 feet in diameter. And it's on skis with rocks for weight, so we get a lot of speed going down, so we get a lot of elevation. And then in the back, I went and got some fireworks that shoot flares. And when we're gonna go up on the hill, we'll light them and shoot flares out of them and push it over the edge. So it should get some momentum as it goes down, and when it hits the lift, it should fly in the air and be a plum, whatever that is.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go!
When I first started skiing here years ago, it was back when they used to have rentals and they did night skiing, and it was a pretty active place. And then the military pulled out, and a lot of people, I think, in town thought the whole place shut down. And so it went into a real slump. They actually, I guess, almost had to shut down. Then it was up to the volunteers to kind of put the pieces back together.
And we're getting our barbecue stuff ready, and we just stopped selling regular food. It's taking us a little bit of work.
You know, the fact that it's still here kind of surprises some people. But yeah, we have some very dedicated people. They kept this place alive. If it hadn't been for those people, this place would have died.
There's a lot of volunteers here every day. Each left has somebody at the bottom and someone at the top. You have a couple of people that show up early to dig it out and set it up and get ready. And then you rotate people. Every 2 hours you have a shift so people don't get too tired, and you move them around, you know, so they stay alert. It's a big group of people.
I'm in a caregiving profession, so Ski Patrol just kind of fits with that. You know, having that medical knowledge about how to treat wounds and save a life could come in handy in a lot of different situations in my life. I've always been kind of an adventure junkie. I'm one of those people that don't like to sit still. I like to have something to do. Boredom isn't in my agenda. A lot of my patients sometimes think I'm crazy when they find out all the things that I do, you know, for fun. I've done a lot of things that most people think are pretty dangerous, and I've been injured a few times. Well, I broke my leg up here 1 year. I've hurt my shoulder. Last weekend, I hurt my wrist. I was out kayak camping, and I had a bear come up and sniff the back of my head through the tent. Not once, but twice during the night. It's like, oh, you don't get that experience hardly anywhere else. No, Alaska's just a little more extreme.
All right, so that was a segment that we recorded out at Arctic Valley a few years ago for our Indie Alaska program. And now I'm in a ski shop. I'm in the back room at Ski AK with Russell Sell, who's an owner of the shop, and Tony Lombardo, who's a ski tech. And what we thought we'd do is talk about how to get your skis ready for the downhill ski season. What you need to do, if I know a lot of us just like leave them in the garage and then pull them out when it's time to go, but actually what if you got your skis prepped and got some tech work done on them? So what kind of stuff should people be thinking about just in general, you know, not necessarily like somebody who skis all the time, but you know, somebody who wants to have their skis in good shape for the year?
Sure. Well, I think that they're both one and the same. If you have an individual that's skiing regularly and those that are partially maybe doing 2 or 3 weeks of the season, uh-huh. You know, you put your skis away at the end of the year and they come out the other side in the fall, you know, and the bases are all gray and they're dried out and the edges have got dings and nicks and rust and things like that. So the approach is for the ski owner to come in and essentially get some work done on their skis. Preserve the life and the duration of their investment. And we can do that by treating the bases. Sometimes we might have to grind the base and bring it down to where the structure's whole and useful. And then we can add hot, warm waxes in there. We can put it in a hot box for 12 hours. It's like putting lotion on your hands. Uh-huh. It just soaks into the pores and it preserves that P-TEX base for a longer duration.
Which is going to make the ski has last longer and it goes faster, right?
Yeah, and it preserves your investment over time, and mm-hmm. you're right. And so when we do that, we can just leave that wax on over the summer, and then we come out at the other end in the fall, uh-huh. and we'll bring them in, and we scrape that wax off, and we start laying in waxes that are appropriate for, like, the front side skier or uh-huh. the backcountry skier. In the front side, meaning the resort type of skier, we would start adding colder waxes first, and then we would build up that hardness, much like you would do in Nordic when you put that green special on. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? You just build that in and you make it strong. And then when it comes time for the real snow to arrive, then you add the specific waxes that you like to have, whether it's an 8 for warmer conditions or a 7, you know, for a colder, drier, harder snow. And so it preserves that the ability of the ski to perform at its best.
So can you, I brought my skis in. Can you look at my bases and just see, like, how do they look? I mean, frankly, I haven't done anything with them in a really long time.
Yeah, these look like they've been remounted a couple times.
Yep.
And they've got some bindings on them here. And so, by and large, your bases look not too bad. overall. Normally when I look at a base or the techs look at the base, we can run our fingers down the sides of the edges, uh-huh. and we find these little hooky spots and things of that nature. It tells uh-huh. me that you probably rocked them up a little bit or hit trees or what have you. And we want to get that nice and smooth and sharp because it'll demonstrate performance in your skiing if you have good solid edges. The bases could use a regrind to get a little bit gray here. So we take that down, the P-Tex down to a natural form, mm-hmm. and then we would put in a warm wax and just restore it.
Okay.
And then we'd put it through the edging machine, and we would take all these burrs out and just make it a little bit better for you.
Uh-huh.
Some people come in and say, well, I want my edges, 1 degree or 3 degrees because they're a specific knowledgeable skier, and that gives them additional performance. And we can do that as well. But for the average skier, we'll set the skis, at a standard, base bevel and edge bevel, and restore that ski, take out all the scratches that you have down here that you've hit on rocks and stumps and what have you, and you'll find that overall you're going to perform better on the ski.
Yeah.
And this is an older ski, so I might suggest that you folks should bring in some older skis, consider demoing some new product, because you'll be surprised at how your performance level just jumps at a quantum level. But that's essentially what happens with the bases here. Now, the bindings, we want to make sure that we have bindings that are appropriate and serviceable.
Mm-hmm.
And we have criteria that we have to meet. Some bindings are not serviceable, and we will let you know because we will not work on them.
When you mean serviceable?
They've timed out. Their age level, their warranty, their performance, their factory specifications have all timed out. So we would not work on
those. We're talking about safety here.
Safety, purely safety. So these seem to be in fine shape. And binding adjustments are well worth the while as well. Going over the binding, making sure that the mount, the mounting is true and correct, the screws are all in place.
Mm-hmm.
And if not, we would bring that to the attention of the owner and ensure that they have the ability to make a decision to either replace the bindings, or in this case, you've got multiple mountings going on here. Maybe we can't mount them again, so we have to look at another option that's most affordable and appropriate for the owner.
Yeah. What about the stick tightness of the binding? Is that something you look at on a regular, how easy is it going to let go?
The tightness? Oh, you mean the din setting?
Yeah.
Yeah, the din setting is set by age, weight, and height, and then we have a chart here that really defines the adjustments. And these charts are updated every year.
Uh-huh.
So when we do specific binding adjustments, the techs will go by this chart and go by the weights and the experience levels on our sheets of intake, what we fill out to bring the ski
in. Yeah.
And so if there's any question about that, the tech can visit with the owner about the din setting.
But once it's set, it's just going to stay there. So if you haven't changed as a skier, you probably don't need to worry about it?
It depends on your age.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a more aggressive skier at 35, right, and now all of a sudden you haven't skied in 5 years, you want to get back into it, your bindings are still in good shape, your skis are pretty decent, but all of a sudden you're feeling a little bit of risk. Maybe I broke my leg a year ago. Maybe I've had a heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I've had all these medical issues that will prevent me from being that ripper that I once was. So a discussion on settings of bindings to protect your safety is something that we would
On the flip side, if you become a better skier, if you're moving up from sort of an intermediate to an advanced skier, you want to get them higher so that the ski doesn't fall off when you're skiing aggressively.
Absolutely, sure. You would have that opportunity to discuss those points with the techs as well.
Uh-huh.
And again, binding placement on the ski, there's a lot of factory settings, center mount. Sometimes when someone's buying a new ski and new bindings, and they're a good skier, they may have decisions on their own as to where they would like to find their balance point. And that could change by a centimeter or two forward or aft of factory setting center. So those are discussions that we can have as well. And we have many skiers here that are knowledgeable enough to say, well, for the reasons I'm skiing this type of terrain, I would like to have this binding forward or aft to center, and for these reasons. So they talk with the tech, they make an informed decision that works well for the owner.
Yeah. So it's a beginning of season and end of season thing. It's really just keeping your skis maintained so that you just have the most fun and you have the best performance.
Absolutely. And it really is all about enjoyment, having those great memories on the mountain with your friends or your family, what have you. But it's also about safety and preserving your investment, Much like a ski boot, which is generally a 5-year investment. A ski can be a 5-year investment or more if they're well taken care of. And that requires service and waxing during the year, depending on the type of snow you're in, whether it's harsh man-made or natural, a little more moist. early season rocks and twigs and all that kind of carnage. And then late in the season when we really want to take the skis back and treat them before we put them away.
Well, thanks. I wish we had more time, and I think we'll come back again. Russell Sell at Ski AK. We're back here with the techs working on skis, and I'm sure you guys are really busy. And
we've been extremely busy this year.
Thanks a lot, Russell.
Thank you very much, Charles. Look forward to seeing you again.
Stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
It's our time for our training calendar segment on Outdoor Explorer, and my regular guest for the calendar is Coach Lisa Keller. Her business is called Multisport Training of Alaska. She trains up folks to do endurance events like triathlons, and has been at it for a long time, so she really knows what she's talking about. And we were with you last month, and we're going to try to be with you once a month. As you think about what big events you are going to do, we're going to maybe give you a little encouragement and a little knowledge about how to have a smart plan if you want to do a triathlon or a marathon or a big bike race. We're coming right up on the Frosty Bottom. That's a big winter bike race. Too late to train for that.
It's too late. Everything should be in the bank by now.
What you've got, right? So if your race is a week or two ahead, you're tapering, you're taking it easy, just doing a little loosening up, being ready for snow conditions.
Right. So at this point, you don't want to do anything crazy like going out for a 4 or 5 hour bike ride. Just don't do that. All your rides should be short. There's nothing else you can really put in the bank except to remind your body what to do at this point. So at this point, I wouldn't have a ride that's much more than an hour, hour and a half. I would definitely be looking at my nutrition and also looking at what the possible weather conditions could be. Frosty has had just sometimes great conditions, hard-packed trail, and sometimes people are slogging through the snow. So you have to be prepared for whatever it's going to throw at you.
Right. So if you are thinking about the big spring events like the Tour of Anchorage, or maybe you're traveling outside to Lava Man, hopefully you've already got a training plan well in play. What place would you be here now when we're talking January and your event is in March?
So the Tour of Anchorage and also Susitna in February are definitely very race-specific workouts at this point. You know, in the middle of the week, you might have some shorter, faster stuff that, you know, you can handle when you're working and stuff. But on the weekends, you would definitely want to be on pieces of the course for the Tour of Anchorage and Susitna if you can get out there and do some time at race pace that you anticipate doing. You're dialing down your nutrition at this point. For Lava Man, you're starting to do bricks. So you're doing a brick is a where you do a bike that's specific to the time you're going to be on the bike, and then you get off and you run a specific pace that you're trying to hold for the race in Lava Man. With Lava Man, also at this time, you definitely want to be trying to do most of your workouts, as many as you can, in very warm conditions. Because we go over there in March, and it's, you know, it's always 85 over there and usually a little humid. And so you really want to be, you know, setting up your bike on a trainer in a hot room. And I even at sometimes have like put a space heater blowing right on me, because you do get those really hot winds over there.
Yeah, that's very true. You know, I run outside and it's 70 degrees, 75 degrees, and I'm sweating, and people just laugh at me.
Yeah. They know the Alaskans when we come.
That's right. What about summer events? The Mayor's Marathon is at the solstice. I think you want to be into you're setting your base at this point. You're sort of started your training plan, right?
Correct. Hopefully you've been doing at least a little bit of running. Uh-huh. And so now you're going to start working on doing at least one run a week that's getting longer and longer. And so, for instance, if you start at an hour run on a weekend, the next weekend you might run for an hour and 10 minutes and then an hour and 20 minutes. And then remember that you always have those 3 weeks, and you always take a recovery week on the fourth week before you go back to building, you know, hour 40, hour 50, 2 hours. So those runs are just endurance runs. You should be able to talk the whole time. Remember, we're in the general phase of training, so you don't have to do any race pace or anything like that. You're just going out and enjoying a long run.
Now, if you're a normal person, you work and maybe have kids and all other stuff, and maybe you're taking one weekend day to be your own, because if you're doing a long run, you're going to need a long rest and you're going to feel pretty cruddy. But what do you do the rest of the week when you've got maybe an hour after work or you've got 45 minutes?
It's really doable. In fact, when I train people for marathons, most people are super busy. So I only train most people on 3 days a week of running. It's you could have a great race on just that. So one day could be a fartlek run, which is means speed play. It's Swedish for speed play. It means you just change your running around the speed. Maybe sometimes you go fast up a hill or fast to a light pole or whatever. It just mm-hmm. always changes. The other run, eventually I like to try to build that midweek run up to an hour and a half, but it can start at an hour, even 45 minutes really. And again, you would want to do maybe some sort of structured speed that just gets you sort of thinking, your body thinking about running a little bit faster. So a favorite workout of mine is 20 to 40 minutes of 1 minute fast, 1 minute slow. And I don't say what the fast is, it's all relative.
Right.
So it's different when it's out on the snow as it is on a treadmill.
Yeah.
But it just changes things up and gives you a little bit more intensity in a shorter workout.
So you
workout.
Just don't keep plodding along doing the same thing every time.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you mentioned something in our last interview about when you're just getting started on your training plan, being in the gym and lifting weights and all that. And I think most people think of runners and endurance athletes as being really skinny and not having big muscles. Mm-hmm. But why would you want to be lifting weights? Why is that an important part or doing core exercises?
I just think it's vital. I've always done some sort of strength training, and I've been at this since I was like 12.
Right.
And in high school, at East High School, I started lifting weights when I was there. And it just builds a really good foundation. So but there's not a huge amount of evidence yet that it prevents injuries. But what they are starting to show is in an event like a marathon or a triathlon, it keeps your body from breaking down in the later stages. So it just keeps you stronger longer during an event, during an endurance event. And then it's also important to work those, we're very linear when we're doing all these sports, maybe not so much a skate skiing, but most of us are just like going in one pattern. You want to work those little balancing and stabilizing muscles that are also lateral. So that's also very important.
Right, so you're kind of complete. Yeah.
Right.
Great. Well, Lisa, you'll be back with us again in February?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. It's the Training Calendar with Lisa Keller on Outdoor Explorer. And stay with us. We will be back again next month. And of course, we'll be back with more of the show right after this. Well, back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. And we're going to talk about a conservation issue that's happening right here in Anchorage. And it's really exciting because it's something that you would think would be difficult and take forever and a lot of bureaucracy. But it seems to actually be happening, which is the removal of an old dam on the Eklutna River. Eklutna River goes down from Eklutna Lake to the ocean, on the extreme east end of the municipality of Anchorage. Dam was there for a really long time, and a private group actually went and raised the money to remove the dam, and that is happening, and it's like going on. And it's one of those things that it's kind of exciting to see, like actually making progress on a conservation issue. And the guy who's making it happen is Brad Micklejohn. He's with the Conservation Fund, which is I want to find out more about what it is, but a big philanthropic fund, and they've come up with quite a bit of money to do this. Thanks for being here, Brad.
Yeah, Charles, happy to be here. Thanks.
So why did it, tell us what this dam is and why it needed to be removed.
So, Charles, the lower Eklutna River Dam was built in 1929. It served as a hydropower production facility for about 30 years and was decommissioned in the mid-1950s. And it's been abandoned, orphaned, unmaintained all that time, roughly 70 years.
Wow.
And during that period of time, it backfilled with sediment. So an orphaned, unmaintained dam upstream of a highway and a railroad and community is categorized as a high-risk dam. And all parties, the Office of Dam Safety, the Corps of Engineers, have identified this for removal because it's serving no function and it's providing it's causing some level of risk to the downstream.
In other words,
facilities.
If the dam broke, and then it would be yeah.
Right. If that dam had failed catastrophically on its own as a result of an earthquake, then there could have been impacts to the highway and the mm-hmm. railroad downstream.
Mm-hmm. And what about the sort of the conservation aspect of it? I mean, dams stop fish, and they just sort of they mess up a lot of things. Was it causing a problem there?
Clearly it was. I mean, this is a 70-foot tall structure blocking a salmon river. And this river has five species of salmon in it, including Cook Inlet King salmon. Last year, 200 Cook Inlet Kings returned to the Eklutna. And those fish can't jump 70 feet. They can't get upstream. This dam's about a mile and a half up from the tidewater. And so the fish are limited in their spawning habitat, and they can't clearly get to Eklutna Lake. And that's the big prize in this, taking this dam out so the fish can move all the way up to Eklutna Lake.
Yeah, so that's it sounds like a huge project for a private organization to take on. It sounds like something the government would do.
It's a massive project. I'm really fired up about this one, Charles. I've been working in conservation for 30 years, and I've never had a project like this one. It's really it's an awesome project to be involved with. Most of these big dam removals around the country take decades to happen. Usually assembling the funding is really complicated, really difficult. You got a lot of bureaucracy to go through. And in this case, we've gone from concept in 2014 to nearly completion here in the fall of 2017. Really record time for one of the most ambitious dam removals in the western U.S. and certainly here in Alaska. We haven't done a project like this before.
Wow, that's amazing. So how did that happen?
Well, I saw a movie called Damnation about the nationwide effort to take down dams, and there are some 20,000 orphan deadbeat dams across the country that are kind of targeted for removal. And I got inspired by the movie. I saw the movie at the Beartooth, and I thought, oh, there must be a dam around here I can take down. And I'd heard about this at Kootenai River Dam, but I'd never actually been to look at it. And so it inspired me to go into the canyon and check it out. And the dam sits in this 400-foot deep canyon. It's a spectacular spot. I thought, well, maybe there's a way we can sort this out. So I just started applying my mind to it, talking to folks in my organization, talking to people who'd done big dam removals around the country, and getting a handle on what might be involved and what the costs might be. And it quickly became apparent that if we did it quickly and privately, that we could do it in a short period of time for a lot less money than these government-funded projects take. So all in all, we're in about $7.5 million, and as of the end of October, the dam is about 95% down.
Wow.
We did most of that work in 2017. We did a bunch of staging work in 2016, and we have a little more cleanup to do in 2018. But it's been a really dramatic project. We have the largest crane in the state, this 400-foot-tall crane on site to help lower the equipment into the canyon. We built a 500-step aluminum staircase down into the canyon to provide access. And we had a lot of different challenges along the way working on the dam removal this summer. Very unstable soils, a very steep canyon with potential for rockfall. But we worked through all of those challenges. One of the things that I'm most pleased about that is that we partnered with the Kootenai Native Corporation to do this work. They have a construction subsidiary that was competent to take on a task like this. And, you know, it's their river. It's near their village. The dam was built without their permission, without anybody asking them back in the 1920s. And it devastated the salmon runs that those people used to rely on. So these folks at Kootenai were motivated to get the job done timely, under time frame and under budget.
Wow.
And
yeah, when did that happen?
It never happens. I mean, if this had been a standard construction contract with another big firm, we would have been hit with change orders, and
right.
I'm sure we'd have major cost overruns.
But they're taking care of their own land and their own lifestyle. That's nice.
And they're putting their shareholders to work. Uh-huh. So we're paying them to do the work to fix up their river, which I think is a great part of the story.
Huh. So this, I mean, I don't think anybody ever went and looked at this dam. Like, you had to kind of climb down into a gorge to even see it. Right?
About the only people who ever saw this dam on a regular basis were the ice climbers. There's a bunch of ice climbing down in this canyon. And if you drive up to Kootenai Lake, you pass by the dam, but you don't know it. Just off the Kootenai Lake Road, there's this steep-sided canyon that drops, 400 feet down to the canyon bottom, and that's where the dam is located. And I've been driving that road for 25 years, yeah. And I never knew that dam was that close to the highway. So, fortunately, it was not terribly remote. We could drive to the edge of the, we built a road to the edge of the canyon, installed the crane, and the crane was used to lower all the excavators and bulldozers and backhoes and drill rigs down into the canyon. And then the staircase was built so the workers could access the site.
Yeah. So you say that you raised the $7 million and that was a lot cheaper than it would have been if you'd done, government funding and all that. But I don't know how to raise $7 million. How do you do that? I mean, obviously there are like wealthy people out there who support the Conservation Fund, or how does that work?
Yeah, well, we've been really fortunate to have a lot of broad support, not just from here in Alaska, but around the country. There's a fund set up by the Hewlett Foundation of California targeted on major dam removals. And the Hewlett Foundation had set aside $50 million for a big dam removal project. So we were able to work with those folks to get some funding. The Rasmussen Foundation has committed $250,000 to the project. We've gotten money from Patagonia to make a movie about the project.
Oh, nice.
We got money from Orvis. Funding through Trout Unlimited, funding from Wells Fargo, the Alaska Community Foundation. So a lot, really a broad base of support for this. And sometimes if you do a big, exciting project, it's easier than a smaller, kind of, you know, less dramatic project. So this one has actually been surprisingly easy. We've had tons of support from a broad political spectrum. The permits came together much faster. We thought we'd be in the process of procuring permits for, you know, 4 or 5 years. That all came together in a matter of a year. I think the time was just ripe for this. You know, here's a dam that, you know, wasn't serving any function. It was blocking fish, was sort of a cultural injustice to the Eklutna people. And it needed to come down for a lot of different reasons. So everyone sort of gelled around that idea and made it happen.
Well, I mean, it took a spark plug, too. I mean, the fact that you went to this movie, which I think is I bet the guys who made the movie feel good about that. And then you knew how to round up this kind of money. I mean, that's like not something that happens without a tremendous amount of effort.
I want to give a lot of credit to the people of Eklutna. I mean, this is, it wouldn't have happened without them. The dam sits on their land. I think that's the key part of this story is, you know, Eklutna has given so much to this community over the years. They have, I think, 7 different school sites on land they lease to the municipality for like $1 a school site. They have highways and railroads that have gone through their villages. They've had, you know, issues with acculturation with alcohol and drug issues. And, you know, they are the largest landowner in Anchorage. And I think folks are waking up to their importance to this community and what they've given and the need to give something back to them.
Right. And it's all their land originally. I mean, when anywhere you are in Anchorage, that was land that they used for their hunting and their fishing. And the village was sort of their winter abode. And then their summer abode was an entire bowl.
That's correct.
Know, every stream that you're on, it was used to be used by the Eklutna.
Yep. So now the project turns to the next phase, which is restoring normal water flows to the river. And at present, no water flows out of Eklutna Lake. Most of the water in the Eklutna River Basin is diverted for hydropower production. A smaller percentage goes to Anchorage's drinking water, but roughly 90% of the water in the Eklutna watershed is being exported out of the basin for hydropower.
Just through a tunnel or something? Or
yeah,
how does that work?
There's a tunnel through the mountain that starts at Eklutna Lake and it goes through Twin Peaks. It's about a 4.5-mile long tunnel, and then it exits on the Kinnick River side of the mountain, drops down to a power plant next to the Kinnick River where it generates roughly 20 to 30 megawatts of power. Mm-hmm. And that facility is run by Matanuska Electric, Chugach Electric, and Municipal Light and Power. It's a triumvirate of utilities. They received that facility from the federal government. It was built by the feds in the 1950s and then transferred to the three utilities in 1997. And when it was transferred to those utilities, they took on an obligation to mitigate for the impacts to fish and wildlife habitat. The obligation to mitigate was delayed roughly 30 years, and that due date is coming up.
We want you to mitigate, but we don't care if you do it for 30 years.
That's and really crazy. What happened is a lot of people kind of lost sight of that, and it was thanks to Rick Sennett, who did an excellent series in the Anchorage Daily News and Dispatch News about the Eklutna, the salmon in the Eklutna, the power production, these agreements. He unearthed all this history that had kind of been forgotten. I mean, you know, most of the people who'd signed those documents have either died or retired.
Well, they figured 30 years, that's forever, right? It means we don't have to worry about it.
It pretty much was.
Yeah.
You know, I'm in the mitigation business, and typically now, if you're going to have an impact, you have to mitigate right away. You have to mitigate at the time of the impact. So this was a, you know, classic Ted Stevens sweetheart deal, you know, to postpone the obligation another 30 years. So we've dusted those documents off and reminded all the parties that there's an obligation that's coming due in 2022. And in October of this year, 2017, the Anchorage Assembly passed a resolution unanimously, co-sponsored by Forrest Dunbar and Fred Dyson, to direct the utilities to begin this process of studying the impacts and restoring the natural flows to the Eklutna. So that process is what comes next. They haven't been, the utilities haven't been motivated to restore the flows with this lower dam.
When we say restore the flow, we just mean like instead of taking all the water for power production, just let it go in the river where it naturally would go?
To allow some water to flow in the river. Right now, the riverbed is dry, leaving Eklutna Lake.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, if you propose to do that now, if you propose to take all the water out of a salmon-bearing river now, it wouldn't pass.
Of course,
that would not be legal. But, you know, back in the day when this happened, you know, salmon were everywhere, the natives, who care, you know, it's like, that was just the way business was done. But we know better now.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're trying to find that balance between power production, drinking water supply, and salmon. And I think it'd be really cool to have a major salmon run this close to Anchorage. Aklutna Lake looks a lot like Kenai Lake. It's a six-mile-long lake. There are still landlocked red salmon trapped in that lake. The folks that I've talked to say, well, they weren't stocked there. They're probably residual from prior to when those dams were built back in the 20s.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But there are no scientists there studying exactly how many fish were there in the 1920s or how much water was there. So it's sort of like put it back and to see what happens.
You know, we know the salmon are there. All five species still use the Aklutna. And salmon swim upstream as far as they can go. And we know that the sockeye got to Aklutna Lake at one point, and they would do so again if they had a way to get there. So that's the next phase of this, is getting that whole natural flow of water from tidewater to the lake restored, so that, you know, we can restore not just the lower part of the river, but the salmon running into the lake as well.
That's fabulous. So what can listeners who want to support this? It sounds like you've got the money you need. And I don't know how many of our listeners have millions of dollars anyway, but how can people support
this? Well, actually, I want to say we're still in fundraising mode.
Oh,
we're darn close. We're about 90% of the way there, but we would be grateful for additional support. If you'd like to help us, you can go to www.conservationfund.org. You can follow a link to donate specifically to this project.
We can put that link on outdoorexplorer.org. So just go to our page, and we'll have the project there, and you can follow it to Brad's organization. What about support with assembly members or with the electric utilities to get the water back?
Yeah, I think that's where the public can stay involved. The process to restore the flows, working with the utilities, is probably going to go on for a couple of years. And there are a lot of political levers that I, you know, could use some help pushing. Contacting your members of the assembly, contacting the governor's office. The governor's office plays a very big role in these negotiations to restore water flow. And if we're going to live up to our self-characterized salmon state, this is a great place for the governor to make a claim and say, okay, you know, we want to bring these fish back because it's a great thing for all the people of Alaska. I had the...
it's hard to imagine many people being against it, other than I guess the utilities are getting some free electricity from the project that they'd have to give up.
Yeah, and it's worth pointing out that the power generated by the Aklutna Power Project is 1% of the South Central power production. You know, hydropower is a great thing, provided that it doesn't impact salmon, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And when Chugach Electric proposed to build a facility on Snow River, they heard loud and clear that Alaskans put salmon first. As the chair of the Chugach Electric board told me, yeah, we get it. Alaskans place salmon above guns and God. And that's, you know, if there's anything Alaskans agree on, and maybe the only thing we agree on is salmon.
Yep, I think you're right. Well, thanks, Brad. This is a wonderful project, and it must have a great sense of accomplishment for you, but also just thanks from people around Anchorage. If you hadn't seen that movie and gotten started on this, the dam would still be there.
It's been very rewarding, and we're almost done, and you know, maybe it's my my swan song I'll ride on that crest.
Well, we hope you hang around for a while yet. Brad Micklejohn, he's with the Conservation Fund. You can find out more about them on our website at outdoorexplorer.org. Just click on today's show, and Brad's been on our show before talking about his adventures around Alaska. I'm sure he'll be back again. Thanks for being here, Brad.
Thanks, Charles.
That's all for Outdoor Explorer today. I'm Charles Wolforth. I want to thank my guests. In the first segment, we heard from Tegan Hanlon from the Anchorage Daily News and John Schandlmeyer, musher and trainer, talking about the Iditarod. And then we had Russell Sell from Ski AK talking about ski maintenance. Lisa Keller was our coach for the training calendar. She's from Multisport Training of Alaska. And finally, you just heard, of course, from Brad Micklejohn from the Conservation Fund on the Aklutna Dam removal. Our producer at Outdoor Explorer is Eric Bork. Assistant producer is Hannah Duro. Come with us again next week, and I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.